This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. J.C. Kane producing today. Your number is 877-217-5757. A couple of reminders. Podcasts for this show are available shortly after the conclusion of the program each day at talklouisiana.org. And later today at 2 p.m., the governor will have his monthly chat with us on WRKF. So hope you'll be around for that as well. We start with Professor Paul Starr. He is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton, the co-founder and founding editor of the American Prospect magazine, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction, and his latest work is Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. And good morning to you, Professor Starr.
All right, glad to be with you.
Nice to hear your voice. And what is the lament you have about so-called entrenchment as far as a danger to our society?
So this is a book about the struggle over the power of concentrated wealth. And it's an ongoing struggle that goes back. I begin with the struggle over the power of landed aristocracies in Britain and Europe, and to some extent in the American colonies, and then with the power of slaveholders. Again, you know, an example of concentrated wealth and political domination. And it hasn't gone away. I mean, you know, it comes up in new forms. And over the last, last 50, 60 years, we've seen a considerable growth in economic inequality in the United States. We've seen most of the gains from economic growth go to people at the very top. And there is consequently a shift in political power that's gone along with that. And so that's my lament, if you want to describe it that way.
Your number is 877-217-5757. If you'd like to join the conversation, email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. A brief passage from the book from Paul Starr. America has had long periods when concentrated wealth has dominated both politics and the courts. Economic inequality is a structural source of political inequality that the law has not rectified. Building on those structural advantages, a conservative political party can use a combination of means, some complying with legal norms, others not, to entrench constitutional changes that narrow the scope of government and citizenship as long as that party continues to win several elections in a row and secures enough seats on the Supreme Court to consolidate its hold. Are we experiencing that now?
Well, I think that's a big question for 2020. We still have a democracy in the United States. We still have elections. The incumbents sometimes get thrown out. Incumbents have a huge advantage in this country. If you just look at the data on the rate of reelection of political incumbents. So when people get in power, they've got a lot of means to keep power. And it's the challenge of a democracy to keep the road to power open so that the people who have it can sometimes get thrown out by the voters. But there are these moments. I make a distinction in this book between ordinary politics and what I call the politics of entrenchment. So ordinary politics is the zigging and zagging that, you know, that goes on, you know, from day to day. I mean, you know, one year the budget is raised for something, the next year it's cut. Okay. You know, you lose a battle. Now you come back the next year and you win it. But then there are other times when the changes become very hard to reverse. And when those are about, you know, really fundamental things, that can have very lasting consequences. And I think, you know, we are at a moment like that. So right now, just to come back to the Supreme Court, the conservatives on the court have a 5-4 majority. And sometimes you have a lone dissenter. Justice Kavanaugh recently sided with the liberals in an antitrust case, very important case. But if Donald Trump is reelected, I think he'll have the opportunity to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe Stephen Breyer. And for conservatives, that's a great thing. We could go from a 5-4 court to a 7-2 court. If it's a 7-2 court, it's going to last in conservative hands for a long time. So that's an example to me of where political power can produce this kind of lasting entrenchment. And again, if you're in favor of it, that's great. If you're not, and I'm not, that's a real problem.
Well, by all rights, it should be a 5-4 majority for Democrats. If Merrick Garland had been confirmed, he was nominated while President Obama was still in office, still had almost a year to go in his term, the Democrats would hold that majority. So there are ways to game the system, and Mitch McConnell found a way to do it, and he got away with it. So let's say hypothetically, Professor, let's say hypothetically President Trump wins re-election, but the Democrats get control of the Senate. I would guess the Democrats would not allow a vote on a Supreme Court justice for the entire second term of Donald Trump if there was an opening.
Well, that's an interesting question. And this has to do with the question of whether you try to keep the old norms, the old rules in place, the old rule in this case being that the opposition party in the Senate does not block all of a president's nominees for the Supreme Court or other roles, or do you play the game tit for tat, you know, like you did that to us, so we'll do it to you now. I don't really know how Democrats would react if they had control of the Senate under Donald Trump. I think it's an open question. I think there'd be a lot of disagreement among them.
Well, getting to the heart of your book, as far as wealth being disparate in our country, there's no doubt about that. And it's something that's been around long before Donald Trump, who is not mentioned all that often in your book. But is he perpetuating what has already been a severe issue for some people in this country?
Well, I think if you look at the tax legislation that the Congress passed in 2017 and President Trump signed, yes, the answer is yes. The benefits from that legislation go overwhelmingly to people at the top. So, you know, that didn't correspond at all to the populist claims that Trump was making.
877-217-5757, Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Starr, professor at Princeton. His book is Entrenchment, Wealth, Power in the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Yes, sir, I think the game plan is one that Rupert Murdoch set up in England and Australia. It's like run fake news through newspapers and media and then just keep buying politicians until you get enough to change the laws to have them, you know, be what you want them to be. And we live in a plutocracy right now. This is not a democracy.
Is that a fair assessment, or is that hyperbole from Phil?
I agree that these days things look like a plutocracy, but I don't agree that it's not a democracy. I still think we have the tools, we have the means to restore more of our democratic tradition. I mean, there's always been this power of wealth. I mean, that's true all through American history. But I don't think it negates the fact that the popular will does often prevail, and it's a contest. It may be a more difficult contest today because of the changes you mentioned in the media. I mean, around much of the country, local and regional newspapers have almost collapsed. They've become mere ghosts of themselves, and instead people are often turning to social media and not getting as good information as they did in the past. That's a complicating factor that we're dealing with today.
Now, a listener notes that the Citizens United decision was a game changer, but it's Tracy at the Capitol. He asks whether or not it really has changed the competitive playing field. Democrats, quite often in national races, the big ones, spend as much or more money than Republicans. It was feared it would be just a complete slam job with Republicans getting all the money from corporations, but that has not been the case. What do you think?
Well, it's also true that some candidates now can raise considerable amounts of money in small dollar donations. But you know, I don't think it is just a level playing field. There's first of all, there's a lot of dark money that's very hard to trace. We don't really have a full accounting of all the money that's a factor in politics. And really, this works in two different ways for the two different parties. For the Republicans, the influence of money reinforces the policy positions that Republicans have. And for Democrats, however, the influence of money cuts the other way. And
we've got to take a break, but we will return with Dr. Starr. His book is Entrenchment. We'll be back after this brief timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Professor Paul Starr. His book is Entrenchment. Much of our politics today, Dr. Starr writes, is a struggle over entrenchment, efforts to bring about change in ways that opponents will find difficult to undo. That is why the stakes of contemporary politics are so high. 877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Starr. Hi, Dan.
Dr. Starr. Is there any truth to what Senator Elizabeth Warren has said, that the federal courts are virtually in the pockets of corporate America?
I'm not familiar with the statement that she made. I do think that if you look at court decisions, not just recently, but really over the last several decades, the decisions that have been made about antitrust, that have been made about labor law, they've sided overwhelmingly with corporate interests. So I think that's at least a good approximation. But again, not every decision. I just mentioned this recent Supreme Court decision where Justice Kavanaugh sided with the liberals. This is an antitrust case, and it went the other way. And I think this is really important now, that people begin to take a close look at how much concentrated power has been developed in these enormous companies that really sit astride certain markets and really limit competition. I think we need a return to antitrust.
David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on the air with Paul Starr.
Good morning. Yesterday, under sworn congressional testimony by the Housing Secretary Ben Carson, he's totally unaware that more than 4 million people are desperately in need of housing and waiting for government to fulfill their application, while the Trump administration is running up debt with borrowed money, giving tax cuts to the wealthy, pretty much unneeded and unnecessary. What does that say regarding the rights of the individual in this country and the administration catering to those who are really in need and not the wealthy?
I don't disagree with you at all about that. I don't know the details of the housing programs that you're referring to, but I think it's clearly the case that many parts of the country, people are struggling to find affordable housing, you can also see these tremendous mansions being built at the other end of the housing market. We need policies that work better for middle-class people, for new homeowners, for young people who are struggling to form families and make it on their own. We don't have that now.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Dr. Starr. The book is Entrenchment, and we do have a continuing issue of wealth and power. And is that going to change? Is there really any end in sight, or is this something that you and I will live with for the rest of our days?
This is an ongoing battle. This is never going to go away. But that's no reason to give up, because the balance can shift. And right now the balance has swung too far in the direction of the power of wealth.
Well, thank you so much, Paul Starr, and congratulations on Entrenchment. Good to visit with you. We're joined now in studio by Dr. Kevin Cope, who arrived at LSU in 1983, graduate of Harvard, MA and PhD, and also a native of the San Diego area, and he spent most of his life now in lovely Louisiana. You're what, 61 years old?
62? I just passed the boundary of 62. Can
62.
You imagine that?
So 36 of those 62 years have been in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Well, most of them. Now and then I've taken a jaunt, may have gone as far as Alexandria, maybe even Krotz Springs.
And you've gotten to know all the fine restaurants in Baton Rouge, and he is a man of the world, Kevin Cope is. Your wife is from?
My wife is originally from Recklinghausen, Germany, but spent most of her professional life in Göttingen, Germany, but now she's been here for about 15 years.
There you go. Well, you're part of the Brain Remain, as Hugh Buckingham, the former professor, once called it. Many people come to LSU and don't leave. Last week we had Wayne Parent, who retired after 37 years at the Old War School. But it seems like chancellors come and go, presidents come and go. Mike Martin, the former chancellor, said LSU is the most political place on the planet, and he's been in a lot of places. And now it appears that, and I think it's evident, that King Alexander, the president of the university, is fighting the political winds that often prevail at Tigertown. What's going on?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I would bet that Mike Martin, when he got to Colorado and then when he got to Florida, said these are the most political places I've ever been, because that's built into the institution of a university presidency. There are a lot of reasons for the phenomenon that you described, Jim. One is that statistics show that the average stay for a university president now is about 8 years. That's actually up from 10 years ago when it was about 4.5. The one reason for this is that any university president, no matter who it is, whether it's somebody as good as Gandhi or as rotten as Stalin, is going to be trapped in a system that does not allow that person really to make any kind of decisions or headway. And as a result, sooner or later, somebody, whether it's the people, the students, the faculty, the Board of Supervisors, the Board of Regents, the governor, the politicians, somebody's going to get tired of that person and push him out. And if that doesn't happen, then the executive search firms, which in a bad or old day were called headhunter firms, will come in and whisper in that person's ear, wouldn't you like to go someplace big like Omaha, Nebraska?
Well, King Alexander is moving to campus. He's selling his home and moving to the campus on Lakeshore Drive, the home that is available for presidents of the university. Nice place.
Certainly is, and it's probably a good thing that at long last he's giving up his housing allowance. I don't know any other faculty member who gets housing allowances for what ought to be covered by salary, but there it is. Now, here I might say this is not quite so dramatic a move mm-hmm. as it seems. That is, think about other people. Think about, say, old Muammar Gaddafi, who lived in a tent on the grounds of his digs. Well, why not something a little more dramatic? Why not put up a teepee on the parade ground?
Well, some would say our president at LSU is underpaid. For example, in the National Football League, Roger Goodell, the commissioner, he makes $40 million a year plus bonuses. The highest-paid player last year was Matthew Stafford of the Lions, who made $26 million, much less than Roger Goodell. Now, our president, King Alexander, he makes a little over $600,000 a year, much less than the football coach or even the defensive coordinator. The basketball coach made $2.5 million. Even the athletic director made more than the president, who now works for King Alexander. So is the king underpaid?
Once again, you've given us a litany of truth, and I will say that the question of athletic department compensation is one that's not going to make anybody happy, not even the illustrious Jim Engster. However, that having been said, I will point out that in the last survey of public university presidents, King Alexander's compensation was, I think, number 47. When you consider there are 2,000 out of there, position number 47 out of 2,000, that's pretty close to NFL first-round draft pick status.
All right, yeah, you make your point, and a listener, Kristen, notes that at $616,000 a year, the president of the university makes more than four times what the governor of Louisiana earns.
That's true, and I believe that number, in terms of national compensation, puts him in the much vilified 1%.
And Dr. Kim Hunter-Reed, who is head of the Board of Regents, she makes about three times more than the governor of Louisiana does, so... Sometimes being governor doesn't pay as well as other jobs, Kevin Cope.
Well, there are all sorts of ways that you can be paid. You can be paid in that currency of honor. You can be paid in the currency of power. And maybe the governor's got a little bit more of that. It's like the old game of paper, rocks, and scissors. Mm-hmm. President of a university or an athletic director might make more than a governor, but the governor can get rid of the former.
I wonder if the governor pays for his laundry, you know, when he does he go to the cleaners like the rest of us?
Well, there's always disposable clothing. If you read any of the travel catalogs, you can buy underwear that you can toss after one use. Yeah. It's compostable and biodegradable.
Maybe they thought that guy sleeping on the couch at the mansion was a laundry guy. I don't know. But anyway, we have the governor with us later today, and we'll ask him what happened. It was the day of his last radio show, and he comes to our studio. God bless him. We love that. He usually has a rather substantial security detail with him, and somehow, some way, some guy got in the mansion, broke an antique table, took a nap on the couch, and the governor was home.
Must have been an antiques collector.
877-217-5757. Back with Dr. Kevin Cope after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. J.C. Kane is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Dr. Kevin Cope is with us, LSU professor for 36 years. He was head of the Faculty Senate for a decade. 2 years now as the past president of the Faculty Senate, and he is monitoring what's going on at the old War School, and right now there are rumors that King Alexander, the head of the university, may be leaving soon, and it would appear that he, if he decides to leave, that he will be able to find a good job. He's had a good reputation, and he has gotten cross with one of the major players in the Baton Rouge business community, Richard Lipsey, who is a Republican, and King Alexander is a Democrat, and they have different points of view on any number of things. And Richard Lipsey wants him out, like right now. Kevin Cope, with this uncertainty, does that mean anything to the faculty, or the faculty really care about this sort of thing?
One thing that has happened in not only LSU, but all American universities, is that the upper levels of the administration have gotten so detached from the faculty that 90% of the faculty don't care directly. Now, what do I mean when I say they don't care directly? Indirectly, they do pick up what's going on upstairs. They get a sense of anomie, of disorder, of perhaps lack of direction or motivation. And that's probably setting in as people start to realize that there is some instability at the top.
Now, King Alexander is noted as a Democrat. He's from Kentucky and in the South, as we know. There aren't that many white male Democrats running around, but on university campuses, there is this perception that it's wildly liberal. Wayne Parent says LSU is not like that, that there is a pretty good conservative representation there.
That is true. There are even some pious, upright, and even a few fundamentalist sort of people among the faculty members. And that is actually probably a good thing for the LSU campus, that it has a higher level of ideological diversity than you find in most universities. And as for King Alexander, well, I would say if people are stereotyping him as a flaming liberal, they probably read a reach for the fire extinguisher, because he's very much in the middle of the road in comparison to some other people out there.
Well, he probably should be as a leader of a university. It is interesting. A few years ago in Tiger Rag, we looked at the voting registration of people, and Nick Saban, when he was here, he was an independent, voted in every election, by the way. Les Miles, independent, voted in the big ones. Paul Maneri, baseball coach, a Republican, voted in no elections since he became head coach here. And Skip Bertman, a Democrat. So, you know, we've got a pretty good cross-section at LSU, but most of the big guys try to stay in the middle, and some try to stay away from politics altogether.
And once again, Jim, you've touched on one of the deep problems of American education, because the nature of a presidency in an American university is to cling to the middle, not offend anybody, curry favor, please the donors, and otherwise try to keep the university stable. But the purpose of a university is to be on the cutting edge, to innovate, to think, and to challenge. How do those two things go together when the leader is stressing moderation and the faculty are charged with doing something new?
877-217-5757. Renee, traveling over the basin. Renee, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Kevin Cope.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Cope.
Good morning.
5 or 6 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, but they combined the president of the university and the chancellor of the whole system together. Do you think that's been a positive move, or should those two positions be separate so that the president can concentrate on the Baton Rouge campus and let the chancellor oversee the whole system?
Thank you, sir, for a searingly hot question. That decision was perhaps good in concept. Maybe it seemed like a good idea, but in practice it's been a disaster because the result has not been that LSU is the lead university among the many that make up the LSU system. The result is that it's become sort of a big engine on idle, providing economic stability and support for the rest of them, but without any clear leadership. The fact is that a university system president has to be all over the map and can't tend the chicken coop here at home. On the other hand, there are lots of eggs being laid in this chicken coop that need somebody to guide them. We have kind of intermediate situation with a provost on the campus, nice enough person, but the structure of the organization does not allow for any real leadership on the LSU campus.
Thank you, Renee. 877-217-5757. Another listener asks about the story in today's Advocate front page of the 27 fraternities listed on LSU's Greek Life scorecard. Six have been kicked off campus, and the latest university officials confirmed that LSU's Pi Kappa Phi chapter will be closed until May of 2023 after university police issued misdemeanor charges last month against three members. Pi Kappa Phi has been on interim suspension since last fall through the Max Groover situation. That was a Phi Delta Theta pledge who died of alcohol intoxication in a hazing incident, and yet another fraternity has been suspended. Is it time to get rid of Greek Life, Kevin Cope?
My simple answer to that one is yes. But here
you
again,
say yes?
Yes, I think so.
You would like to just get rid of fraternities and sweep it clean.
Sweep it clean, perhaps nationalize that property or something dramatic. Here's the problem. That is, these are vestigial institutions from an earlier period in American society, American life. Now they have not become democratic and inclusive and promoting of equal opportunity for everyone. They become little clubs by which to advance the interests of the lucky few who get in or have got parents who've got enough money to help them get through the pledge process. You would think that with all of these charges that you just listed, that this would have already happened. But here's again part of the problem. The fraternities and the sororities have got so much power that, in some sense, the university president cannot control them. I'll give it to King Alexander. He's tried a few times, but he just does not have the ability to leverage against all of those supporters, boosters, donors, and alumni.
Well, many of the movers and shakers graduated from LSU and were members of these fraternities and sororities, and they benefited from their experiences, and I would say that most of them probably had positive experiences, nothing like what happened to Max Groover.
There's a famous poet that is Gray from the 18th century who talks about a village Milton. That is a person out in obscurity somewhere who could have been the great poet John Milton if he'd had the chance. When you say these fraternities help some people, you have to ask how many people they have not helped. And the latter category is a whole lot bigger.
Well, they do have issues, and most of them have never had African-American members, and they sit on state property, and some people say, how can that happen? But it's happened, and it continues to go on.
Looks like to me like you're getting ready to make the case, Jim.
Well, I think that could be changed without throwing them. I don't agree with throwing them off campus, but I think there could be some adjustments.
I'll tell you, we don't even know if they're on campus or off campus. Some of them own their property, some don't. Who knows?
Patrick in Innisfil Estates. JC, hold on for a moment. Patrick, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Patrick. Oops. I'll tell you what, Patrick, I think we disconnected you, so call back if you will. 877-217-5757 is your number, and Kevin Cope, some listeners have responded online about your suggestion to throw them off campus. They say you probably didn't belong to a fraternity, did you?
Indeed, my college forbid fraternities, And my graduate school did not have the conventional fraternities. They had other organizations, admittedly, but those two fine institutions did not allow fraternities to get a foothold.
All right, Patrick, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, I think shutting down these fraternities, not only are you violating people's freedom of assembly, going into these houses and searching them and seeing if they got, you know, beer or alcohol, that's an invasion of their homes. That's an invasion of their Fourth Amendment right to have a secure home. You're violating the Fourth Amendment and the right to assembly. I mean, and these are college campuses. You're supposed to have freedom of, you know, expression, speech.
How would you combat this hazing epidemic that's
been ongoing?
If
somebody gets hazed, you call the police. I mean, because it's illegal to do that. I mean, it's illegal to force someone to do something against their will.
But the guy died, and 20 years ago, Ben Wynn died, and this is...
Yeah, I agree, but that college kids do that. You know, when I went to college, I was in a fraternity, and I never drank. I was in a Catholic fraternity, and I refused to drink. I just didn't drink alcohol back then. I did later now, but, you know, back then I just didn't drink, and I was, I guess I was a different fraternity I was in, but, you know, they knew not to force, but, you know, I guess if somebody's doing something illegal, that shouldn't stop you from still, you know, the police can still enter a house if there's an emergency, if somebody calls the law.
All right, where did you go to college, Patrick?
Missouri University, Science and Technology, which is up there in Rolla, Missouri.
All right. Thank you, sir. Jonathan in New Iberia. Jonathan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. Gentlemen, good morning. I'm laughing at the fact that you made note of some of the institutions that are not integrated, which a lot of it, there's a lot of misconception. Now, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm black, and I belong to a fraternity. I pledged in Alabama, a little small college in Alabama. But the thing is, the black fraternities, to tell you the truth, have never discriminated. Unfortunately, the white fraternities, I know that they had a problem with, Sigma Alpha Epsilon in Oklahoma State. And unfortunately, a lot of these, you know, and all the fraternities and sororities, you know, regardless of ethnicity, you know, dominant ethnicity is what I like to say, because, you know, the black fraternity, I say the black fraternities and sororities are not exclusively black.
All right. I think at LSU there are some exclusively black fraternities, but those fraternities were started because the blacks could not get in the white fraternities. So they both should integrate if they're still segregated.
That's it exactly, Jim. And I would add to that that nobody's saying that the freedom of assembly should be preempted. Rather, that the universities should not be involved in the sponsorship of these organizations. If somebody wants to go and start a fraternity on beleaguered Florida Boulevard or wherever else, fine, more power to that group.
Well, the headline above the fold today in The Advocate, another frat suspended, police levy charges against three Pi Kappa Phi members. And there's also another story about some of these kids who got in trouble being allowed to graduate. And we'll talk some more with Kevin Cope after this brief timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Jessica J.C. Kane producing, and Kevin Cope in for a few more minutes. For a decade, he was head of the Faculty Senate and graduated M.A. and PhD from Harvard, came to LSU 36 years ago, and he's still here, professor of English. And a few questions online at talk@talklouisiana.org that we met. We'll try to get a few of them in before we depart with Kevin Cope. But 877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in under the wire with Dr. Cope. And getting to the holistic admissions issue, which is the stated division between the president of the university and Mr. Richard Lipsey, is that what this is about, or is that really that big of an issue?
It is an issue. I would not say it's the biggest issue that the university has to confront. Part of it is a matter of communication. Almost every university takes into account some of these items that are considered under holistic admissions, but to call it that without a communications plan, without a method to inform the public what it really means, was a gross mistake on the part of the LSU system. So I think what we have here is a typical Louisiana somewhat tragic collision of partial incompetences, that is, not enough communication, not enough explanation, and a few long-term grudges.
All right. Another listener, Jennifer, notes that it is mostly fraternities getting in trouble, that sororities aren't getting in trouble. Why should they be thrown off campus with the fraternities if you had your dream world?
Well, that's a very good point, and the use of the term dream world partly explains that. That is, in the best of all possible worlds, we would not have these kind of organizations that become exclusive little expensive clubs for those who have a gregarious mentality to the expense sometimes of those who have a quieter way of life. In reality, on a day-to-day basis, that's quite correct, that the rap sheet against the fraternities is a whole lot longer than those against the sororities. And so maybe if you got to start somewhere, we should have a case of reverse discrimination, get rid of all of the male fraternities first.
All right. Well, you obviously don't care for the Greek system. If you have a kid in your class who's a member of a Greek fraternity, is that trouble for that person?
Well, no, I usually don't even know whether people are Greek or not Greek. Sometimes I try a test and say, could you say a few words in Greek? No, not really. But generally, that doesn't even come up. That is, the students take the test, do the readings, whatever, and get the grade that they earn.
Well, those houses are beautiful. We wouldn't want those to go away, would we?
Well, of course, we need to preserve these historical landmarks. One of these days, people are going to wake up and ask about the history of LSU architecture, its connection with slavery, its connection with fascism, its connection with a few other unsavory things. You know, the folks around here think it's such a beautiful campus, but it's not all that beautiful. It looks like a set for a Leni Riefenstahl movie.
Oh, it's a beautiful campus.
The trees are beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful campus. But there, and King Alexander is responsible for Raphael Sims becoming Veterans Drive. That was a progressive move, wasn't it?
That was a wise move. It came on a little bit too late, I would suggest, but it did happen.
He hasn't been here that long. There's still a Beauregard Hall, though.
Well, that's true.
We know the Boyds were into slavery.
We always run up against this dilemma. When you make moves like that, somebody says you're violating academic freedom or you are trying to corrupt our picture of history. And then on the other side, somebody says, well, you're just monumentalizing slavery. So you're not going to win in that debate no matter what you do.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Cope.
Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Kevin Cope, 36 years at the Old War School. And, J.C., I think need to get Eric Peterson on the line, so we'll do that. And Dr. Kevin Cope, he is gracious to come here and speak his mind. And since we're a little late getting to Eric, another listener asked, do you get in trouble for making these kinds of remarks? Are people monitoring what you say on the air, Kevin Cope?
Well, I've been doing this for 10 or 15 years, and I've been in trouble a lot of times, but somehow I've survived, which just shows that the institution of academic freedom, free speech, et cetera, these are still strong even in beleaguered America.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. And there we go. There is Eric Peterson, who is the Pelican Institute Director of Public Policy, and he is here to talk about the Fresh Start Act that passed the Louisiana House with no dissenting votes. Tell us about the Fresh Start Act and why you believe it's a good thing for our state.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, the Fresh Start Act is passed in a few states, Tennessee and Mississippi, chief among them. What it really does is say that unless you have a violent or sexual criminal past, that you will not be denied an occupational license when you get out of jail and are looking to reenter society and find yourself a job. This is a big deal, especially for Louisiana, as Louisiana has the 43rd most burdensome occupational licensing laws and licenses 77 low-income professions. I think there's been bipartisan consensus that to reduce recidivism means increasing opportunity for those who have paid their debt to society.
Has this been done in other states successfully?
Yeah, it's been passed in both Mississippi and Tennessee, and while we don't have the longest time period to kind of study those effects, I think the preliminary results are pretty good.
So it now it goes before the Senate. As mentioned, cleared the House, but sometimes that really doesn't matter. How's it looking in the upper chamber?
Yeah, I think overall it's looking pretty good. Louisiana has really been making great strides in the past few years, on a bipartisan basis on criminal justice reform. And I think this is a really big part of about that. And I think our sponsor of the HB 503, Rick Edmonds, the Fresh Start Act, has been doing a great job of selling it to his colleagues in the upper chamber about why this is so important.
Now, Rick Edmonds is one of the most conservative members of the legislature. Your institute, the Pelican Institute, is a conservative-leaning organization, and yet you have been at the the vanguard of criminal justice reform. Why has this been a passion?
I think it starts with the Pelicans founder, Kevin Kane, who really did dedicate his life to criminal justice reform. And I don't think Louisiana would have passed its historic criminal justice reform without him. But more and more, criminal justice reform is a bipartisan issue, right? We're seeing at both the state and the national level, Republicans and Democrats coming together and saying, most of these people who are currently in the criminal justice system are going to be getting out and returning to society, and we want them to have the opportunities to become productive members of society, and not go back to the criminal justice system. And that's something that both parties or, different ideologies can certainly get behind.
Yesterday in The Advocate, a gentleman named Bernard Noble had a column. It says, I was sentenced to 13 years for two joints of marijuana. And he noted in his column that according to figures, nearly 5,000 people are serving sentences enhanced by the habitual offender statute, contributing to our bloated prison population and costing taxpayers millions of dollars. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
So we haven't taken a stance on that kind of issue, but I would say I don't think someone who has, served 13 years in prison for, two joints certainly should be denied an opportunity to come out and find a job in, one of the many professions it takes an occupational license to have in Louisiana. That person is clearly not a danger to society, and I think we'd all be better off if that person was working.
Well, and then you go to the Jazz Fest and you see doctors and lawyers in the crowd smoking marijuana. Should they be put in jail for 13 years?
I certainly, again, we haven't taken a stance on, legalization of marijuana, but we certainly do take a stance on punishment fitting the crime.
Well, 13 years goes way beyond whether it should be legal or not. Should they serve 30 days in jail if a lawyer is caught smoking pot at the Jazz Fest?
Again, I would say we haven't taken a stance on that, but it is something we're certainly looking into as that issue continues to evolve in Louisiana.
Well, Eric Peterson, we'll follow it with you. The Fresh Start Act, which was successful in Mississippi, has passed the Louisiana House and now awaits action in the Senate. Appreciate your comments today. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, happy to help.
Take care. And as we part company today on the 21st day of May, actually, it's the 22nd day of May. 21st, we missed a birthday yesterday, a listener notes. Chris Wallace, and not the Fox News guy. This was Christopher G. Wallace, better known as Notorious B.I.G. He was a young man on his way to superstardom, and he died at the age of 24. He was killed in a shooting that was a result of a feud with some of his supporters and supporters of Tupac Shakur, who also was murdered, and this rivalry escalated out of control with the murder of Shakur in September of 96, and Chris Wallace, Notorious B.I.G., was assassinated on the 9th of March, 1997. The late Mike Royko wrote a memorable column about this and noted that things had changed a lot. Royko died in 97, but before he died, he wrote this column noting that what would have happened if there had been a feud between the supporters of Frank Sinatra and the fans of Tony Bennett. Might have been an interesting time in the 1950s or 60s in our country, but fortunately, these incidents have not been an everyday occurrence, but they have occurred far too often. And this young man had a lot of talent, and he died at the age of 24. And a story that some listeners have noted that they want us to talk about, and we will in the coming days. Last night, Rachel Maddow of MSNBC had a story about David Vitter, who now works as a lobbyist representing a Russian oligarch, and there was a vote to sanction that oligarch by the United States House. The Senate did not take it up because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, wouldn't allow it to be taken up, and then the oligarch ends up investing in a plant that was a $200 million investment in the home state of Mitch McConnell, who then brings up the vote for Wendy Vitter, who became a federal judge. 52-45 was the vote in the U.S. Senate. No Democrat voted for it, but Wendy Vitter is now a federal judge in good standing for life. And we'll talk about that in the days to come. Hope you have a great day today. The governor at 2 o'clock. Until then, stay tuned.